the Senate Health and Social Services Committee to order at 1:31 p.m. on Wednesday, February 19th. We're meeting today in room 205 of the Capitol Building. Please remember to silence your cell phones as a courtesy. Committee members present today are Vice Chair Von Imhoff, Senator Giesel, myself, Senator Wilson. We do have a quorum to conduct business today. At this time, we'll return to House Bill 29, Insurance Coverage for Telehealth, led by Representative Sponholz. On February 14th, we heard an overview of this bill from the bill sponsor and took public testimony. Are there any questions from the bill sponsor this time? I know we also had a discussion upon it was determined to add an amendment to include the parity pay, and it wasn't necessary. And at this time, we can invite Rep. Sponholz and Lori Winghire to the table, Division of Insurance. I think she's going to speak to the parity issue. And then we'll also allow Rep. Sponholz to make any other comments or before we get into the amendment process of this bill.
For the record, my name is Lori Winghire. I'm the Director of the Division of Insurance. Mr. Chairman.
Can you speak to possibly the parity pay issue, if that's necessary or not necessary, or sort of which the thoughts are of that?
Certainly, Mr. Chairman. This bill was heard numerous times last year, and it has been brought up when it was Representative Vasquez, and the parity had never come up before. I don't believe in the way that the bill has been presented or the way it was introduced years ago. I have not seen a concern with the parity from the providers till last week. And most providers have negotiated agreements, and I would think the negotiated agreement would take care of the concern of parity.
Any questions from committee members? And for the record, Senator Begich has joined us. All right. Thank you,
Director. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Rep. Sponholz, any comments? Questions?
Yeah, this is Representative Ivy Sponholz, House District 16, bill sponsor. I'll just sort of, reiterate, just sort of based on Director Winghire's recommendation and in conversations, consultations with providers and insurers, that we've decided that we're not going to advance, ask for an amendment to address parity at this point in time. We want to allow the market flexibility to be able to, negotiate on a case-by-case basis around rates. That will allow, I think, for the most sort of collaboration and innovation as, we're trying to find ways to reduce healthcare costs. We'd like to create opportunities for upside in, healthcare innovation on both sides, both the payer and the provider, and leaving the bill as it is for right now, I think, gives the most flexibility for doing that. If we discover that later on that there are problems with parity, we think we can come back and address that then, but for now we're going to leave the bill as is.
Okay. And I understand that, however, there's effective date change. That's what was recommended by a Division of Insurance. Mm-hmm. Senator Von Imhoff.
Okay, so I do see amendment number one. I move amendment number one.
All right, I'm going to object for purposes of explanation. And if yourself or Ms. Winghire wants to come back to explain sort of the explanation of the changes, and I think committee members have the amendments before them.
Certainly. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Again, for the record, my name is Lori Winghire. I'm the Director of the Division of Insurance. We had discussed with the sponsor's office the need for a somewhat extended effective date, the reason being that forms and filings have to be made, and under the ACA, we cannot amend forms, which this would take mid-year. Forms are filed in the spring for an effective date the following January. So we have to be reasonable in looking at that, the time frame of when the insurers could actually make this effective. Small group is a little bit different, but the individual market in particular is very strict as to when the forms are filed and when they're effective, mm-hmm. and there's not any leeway to say we're going to make this effective September 10th.
Okay. Thank you. Any questions for Director Winghire? Seeing none, thank you.
Thank you again, Mr. Chairman.
I will move my objection. If there's still any objections to Amendment Number 1? Seeing and hearing none, that amendment has passed. Are there any further amendments? All right. Hearing none, is there a motion to move this bill from committee? Senator Von Imhoff.
I move House Bill 29, version 31-LS0274-A, as amended, from committee with individual recommendations and updated fiscal notes.
Right. Any objections? Seeing or hearing none, House Bill 29 has moved from committee. And we'll take a short at ease as we transition to our next presenters. And if the commissioner and whoever at our lifelines would like to come up now, they can get settled in, and we'll take a brief at ease. Today, before us, we have Commissioner Adam Crum and Deputy Commissioner Al Wall here to ask themselves to put on the record. They're going to give an update on what's new and exciting in the world of health and social services here in the state of Alaska. And with that, if you just don't mind asking, letting folks answer questions at the end of each slide and just taking a brief pause as you guys go through the presentation, just remember to two male voices, just put yourselves back on the record, back and forth.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, this is Adam Crum, Commissioner for the Department of Health and Social Services. Appreciate the committee members today for us coming here to give our kind of departmental overview of what's going on with HESS, as we call it. So our department mission, as you see on the first page, is to promote and protect the health and well-being of Alaskans. So to begin with, I'd like to talk about kind of what we have for the next 3 years planned for, what we're approaching for the department, system changes that we're working on. One of them is the systems alignment and change. And what this involves is items like helping families climb the economic ladder by addressing benefit cliffs. This is a topic that is of great interest to Governor Dunleavy and is something I have discussed with many of the committee members here today. The benefits cliff, which is where participants in programs lose more in benefits than they gain through employment, is an issue that has been brought up at many recent federal conferences and is something that the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services is taking the lead on nationally. HHS is the lead agency in the development of a new federal council on economic mobility to focus on cross-cutting issues that cannot be accomplished by a single agency on its own. This will include other federal agencies such as USDA, Education, HUD, and Labor. Another agency under HHS called the Administration of Children and Families offered a recent learning event discussing what is being done in other parts of the country and is encouraging states to share best practices as they develop program, policy, and system solutions that support parents in achieving greater gains in economic stability. Examples of short-term solutions that we can examine and look at with our federal partners are phasing out benefits slowly, extend certification periods or use sliding fee scales, raising eligibility limits, or and with the change of loss of eligibility standards to enable a longer stay on benefits while working. Just to reiterate, these are options that have been presented from a working group that ACF did in Region 1, which is in the Northeast United States. And these are items that they're encouraging other states and other regions, us being in Region 10, to really look at how this would work with our other federal programs. Different longer-term strategies are increasing educational and work supports through job training and skill development initiatives and to provide employer supports to encourage the hiring of these early-stage workers. We are approaching these strategies through the Division of Public Assistance and Work Services. So Work Services is what the Temporary Assistance for Needy Families calls their work program. It's for all participants who are not otherwise exempt to participate in work or job search activities. So DPA, the Division of Public Assistance, is looking to integrate services and funding streams between the TANF program and the WIOA program, or the Workforce Investment Opportunity Program, in the Department of Labor. The Administration for Children and Families has hosted summits to demonstrate how states can take advantage of braiding funding streams to maximize the outcomes through these services. DPA is actively working on increasing employer supports programs through more formalized incentives with employers and job seekers. And they're also addressing an expected increase in what's called the SNAP, or the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, employment and training participation on a statewide basis by switching to a provider agreement rather than an operating grant program. This will allow more flexibility in onboarding new providers throughout the year to meet the needs of communities and recipients in a more real-time manner. And finally, one of the other last things on the systems alignment and change is we have integrated Medicaid into one platform. So we moved Deputy Commissioner Wall over to the Medicaid side. We brought along behavioral health. And so what this allows is the Division of Public Assistance, Senior and Disability Services, the Division of Healthcare Services, and the Division of Behavioral Health, they all have important individual missions, but they also overlap in areas, and this allows us to make sure we have better program alignment and can better serve our Medicaid population. Outside of that move, we are in conversations with sister agencies in retirement and benefits and the Division of Insurance to find ways we can work together for economy of scale and gain efficiencies in technology or service delivery.
And, Senator Begich.
Go ahead. Well, I have some questions about one of the programs you just referenced. Is this the time, or should I?
Yeah, this is a good pause break, to the chair.
Okay, so thank you, Mr. Chairman. Commissioner, you mentioned the SNAP program briefly and the move toward, basically under the SNAP program now there are waivers that can be applied for, and the governor's applied for a waiver that affects areas of chronic and high unemployment, because obviously if you take somebody off benefit because they didn't find a job in an area that has no jobs, it simply doesn't make sense. And two areas that were excluded from that waiver currently by the governor were the Anchorage and Mat-Su areas that now do meet the unemployment criteria. Is there any intention of placing those two areas within the waiver request that the governor has put forward on SNAP? And that concerns me both in terms of the reduction in resources that will be coming into the state and the fact that it could very well place a substantial number of Alaskans in a place where they simply don't have food security. So can you comment on that and let me know a little bit of what our waiver rationale was and if there's a consideration for adding back Mat-Su and Anchorage to that waiver?
Through the chair, Senator Begich, I apologize, sir. So you're referring to the new rule that was proposed by the Federal Nutrition Service, about the ABOD rule work requirement for the SNAP program. That's the Able-Bodied Adults Without Dependents. So a lot of acronyms in this rule. So with that one, that proposed rule, which is to go into effect in April, they actually allowed different definitions for labor market areas. And we had to redefine, because for years, Alaska had worked under just a blanket exemption from the work requirements. And now in order to do that, you have to meet really close defined definitions. And so they provided a couple options on how to do that. One option was a very strict one, and then the second option was much more lenient, and that was the one that the governor, meaning that we allowed more Alaskans in tougher areas to actually be exempted from the work requirements. So that's the one that we submitted. We just recently had some advocacy groups reach out to us asking if we could actually change that, and we're exploring that option. We're having direct conversations now with the USDA and FNS to find out if that is permitted under the intent of the rule. And so it's an ongoing discussion. We're trying to figure out what that is. They have allowed us extra time. We did have a time requirement on when we had to submit our waiver, and that was why we put that forward. Then this advocacy group stepped up. We had a very robust discussion, and so we're approaching it to see what that's going to look like.
Can I follow up?
Thank you. I was hopeful then that you – I am hopeful that you would provide to the committee and to the chairman the update as those talks – as those talks proceed, because I actually am very concerned about this. I would hope that we wouldn't, A, leave federal dollars on the table when we obviously can use them to keep our citizens fed, and B, that we wouldn't unnecessarily inconvenience – I shouldn't say inconvenience. That's an inappropriate word. But we shouldn't unnecessarily place our families at risk for food security if we don't need to. All of us want to see more jobs in the area, which would drop us below that line, and then those areas would not be accessible to the waiver because the unemployment level would be lower. But it's not there now, and so that's partially that's my concern. So, Mr. Chairman, if we can at least ensure that they're communicating with the committee and let us know what the progress of those talks are.
Yeah, through the chair, Senator Begich, yes, we would absolutely like to provide updates on this. One thing from this program as well, through these discussions, we have learned we're going to do a better job communicating directly with these advocates. The threshold for actually determining whether or not an individual can then enter and be exempt from the work requirements outside of the area upon which they live is not a high threshold. And so this is something that we're going to work with some of these groups that work for the Food Center, Food Coalition, items like this, so that they're aware, they can educate individuals. These are the things that we need as a department in order to show them that they can be exempted from this requirement. And so we're going to continue this communication. It's going to be an ongoing process. We're hopefully getting a call back in the next couple of weeks from FNS so we can amend and be ready to go in time for April.
Thank you. All right. Please
continue. So, Mr. Chair, for the next item, when we talk about our overall vision, is the focus on the IT systems. So the department is vast and covers many subject areas, and we collect tremendous amounts of data. But it is one thing to have data and another thing to analyze and utilize that data for informational purposes. With that distinction in mind, we're working to continually improve and upgrade our IT systems to that end. Over the last year, we've made tremendous progress in this regard, examples being the implementation of electronic document management, which will allow DPA employees to scan in paperwork from numerous and historical applications, quickly find info on individuals' overall history. This is also one of the first steps as we explore moving toward a single application interface for all assistance programs, right? Trying to be more responsive to Alaskans in their time of need. Through dedicated efforts and collaboration with the Department of Administration, we have made progress on updating our Microsoft suite department-wide towards a HIPAA-compliant system, which then allows for mobile device management, so employees at OCS can have secure phones that they use in the field to document living situations and transmit that data securely. Just for the committee members so they don't know, currently, because the Department of Health and Social Services is a HIPAA-required or covered entity, in order to have HIPAA-compliant messaging, we have to log into a separate direct service mail protocol in order to have that sort of messaging. So it's an extra burden on top of staff that already have stress and time-consuming items. So we're trying to remove that barrier in their roles as well to make it easier to communicate. Another opportunity for improvement is implementing a viable health information exchange that meets the needs of providers as well as the state. We are focused on addressing the need of an HIE with our chief data officer and chief medical officer taking the lead for the department in these conversations. Upcoming IT projects that will be implemented by the end of this calendar year are the electronic visit verification for the personal care attendants. This is a mandatory compliance issue from CMS. This is usually in our SDS or home and community-based waiver population. And what's called the eligibility verification system for the Division of Public Assistance. This is another item that was encouraged for the department to pursue under SB 74 and as a part of our federal compliance. Both of these systems will help us move and maintain program integrity, so resources are available to serve those that are truly eligible and in need. As a department, we will work to continually implement innovative IT solutions so we can be agile enough to respond to healthcare providers and recipients, as well as broadly utilize data analytics to combat fraud, waste, and abuse. That's another little pause. If you have any questions on it?
Yeah. Senator Geisel.
You know, Commissioner, when I hear Hess talk about innovation in their IT systems, it causes me great concern. Remind me, did you ever get certification of the Medicaid data system? The MMIS, yes, thank you, Senator Von Imhoff. I was, regardless, it was not certified for a significant amount of time. I don't even remember hearing that it actually did eventually receive certification.
Through the chair, Senator Giesel, yes, we did receive certification. That's the MMIS. That's the fiscal agent responsible for Medicaid. So, yes, we did receive our compliance and our federal certification on that. Yes, the IT and the department we're trying to do a rebranding, so to speak. We have been very innovative as we approach. There was, over the years, Alaska, because of our IT systems, may have been a little archaic. We have had agents from the FBI share with our security staff that hackers in other countries would actually use Alaska as a testing ground for their protocols to then deploy on the rest of the country. And they begged us, please, can you guys work and get your systems better so we don't have to keep having this problem? And the IT staff have done a fantastic job over the last couple of years in improving that. Just recently, this may sound a little odd, but we did have a death to the dinosaur party because all Windows 7 programs throughout the entire department, which is a massive lift, were actually all updated and removed because it's no longer supported by Microsoft. But they were able to successfully do that, and that is a massive undertaking for a department of this size. And it was something that we celebrated, had a pizza party. All right, now on to the next step as we move forward, because a lot of the information that we share, we collect data for the state, and we have individuals come in. We have senators, legislators request information and data. We need to respond faster so we can all have live information to respond even better to these individuals in need. So this is one of the goals for the department, is to continually improve and embrace and make this a better running, faster machine.
Follow up, Senator?
Only that it sounds frightening to me, based on the experience with MMIS. And I can't recall how many years it was that system was a profound headache. Mm-hmm. So I hope things go well. Thank you.
And I also share that concern, and not just for this department. I think when I beginning of last last year, I think there was over 34 upgrades to different IT systems in the state, all using different contractors, different programming that wouldn't really communicate with each other and going out for contracting and other items. So I hope that in hopes of making sure that the continuity of just the data can still be used without having the potential issues of the backlogs. I'm glad that you guys got that all taken care of. I'm sure we'll hear a little bit more upon some of that a little later, but I appreciate that. And just also for the record, I just want to let you know we were joined by Senator Schauer.
Thank you, sir. Mr. Chair, through the Senator Giesel, one thing on that as well, the federal process has gotten much more prescriptive when we look at these large IT systems. And so we have to work and get PAPDs, or Program Advanced Planning Documents. As we're in the planning stage, they look at everything to the way we write RFP, to what is the goals of this, the timeline of implementation, and then they can actually approve, depending upon thresholds we meet, even more advanced federal match to pay for these IT systems. And then once those are approved, we get the IAPD, which is the document that is our guidance throughout this and working directly. This is why the role in the commissioner's office that we transitioned, it was an existing role that we moved into to make this chief data officer. That is their primary job, is to coordinate these projects through our federal partners and across divisions to make sure that we are maximizing that use and we are meeting each one of these prescriptive thresholds.
Okay. Senator Von Imhoff.
Thank you. I am glad that you are bringing on board a chief data officer or chief information officer. I'm seeing that more and more across entities that I am exposed to, that this has become a new industry, if you will, job description, to make sure that the large overarching accounting software as well as all the small onesie-twosies also match and talk to each other. And one of the examples that focusing on IT systems, you have large, you have small. One of the small things that I received an email on was an example of, are you looking at potentially debit cards for Medicaid recipients to purchase medical supplies? Something is, I would call it simple, put in air quotes, P-cards, whatever you want to call them. So they're preloaded. They can use them at certain stores. It's a card. I don't know what happens if they lose them. I mean, but it's things of that nature where it's electronically purchased and then it's uploaded automatically into a system where we know that Natasha just purchased, you know, bandages at such and such store on this date. And it's in real time or day delay or something along that line. So those are the kind of things that then you don't have someone to have to data entry this information in. You can take a look at it. You can run reports, things of that nature. So Are you familiar with kind of what I'm talking about? Are you looking at things like that?
Through the chair, Senator Von Imhoff, yes. This was brought to our attention by the Governor's Council on Disability as well as the Key Coalition. This is something we are exploring. The limitations around that are certain. How does that work for the Medicaid match side? Do we have to do dollars up front then get reimbursed? And so we are trying to navigate that. We do recognize the utility for that, particularly in these families in these difficult situations, to where it's the timing. Where do they purchase at? The timing on how they get their materials and the particular brands. It also may evolve into actually cheaper for the state as well, because it's not a Medicaid-approved item that they're getting. It's something that they just need to use. And so this is something that we are working on. SDS is running that down, and we're trying to find – Is this going to be something of utility to the state, and can we justify it to our federal partners? And we're definitely pursuing it.
Thank you. And I have one more question.
Yes, Senator Von der Hall.
Okay, thank you. So, Commissioner Crum, you do sit on the executive committee with me of the Healthcare Transformation Council, and you can see that Representative Sponholz was here. It is myself today, just dropped a bill on the all-payer claims database. That, of course, is in conjunction or along with the Health Information Exchange. We are looking to lower the cost of healthcare eventually by understanding where our healthcare dollars are being spent. Did you want to comment on, in terms of HIPAA-compliant data, whether it's through this particular bill or any other platform, being able to run reports on Medicaid data on where healthcare dollars are being spent regionally, what ailments, in what fashion, et cetera?
Through the chair, Senator Von Imhoff, anytime we can knock down barriers for access to data in an appropriate way, it it ends up being better for the consumer. And so from our perspective, as we already work with Division of Insurance and Division of Retirement and Benefits, a formal agreement like that would be something that we could see beneficial aspects of that. So we've, as a department, we have worked together. We've had internal working groups try to address that particular bill to find out what are some suggestions from the department side and what we think would help benefit the state. Because first goal that the governor gave to me when we took over this role was to actually address the cost of health care to the state of Alaska, right? That would be in the Medicaid program. The second goal is how do you address health care costs for all Alaskans? And so bringing to bear 30, depends on which number you use, 30 to 35% of the population on Medicaid, along with the state employees and the DRB program, there is in the private insurance, there's an aspect there that we could use that information for the better to help health care costs in Alaska.
Please continue.
I apologize, I forgot to change my slide. The next one I actually do is emergency readiness and response. Just on this one, we talk a little bit about our public health division. Many states around the country have counties that perform the public health services. In Alaska, we have the benefit of a centralized public health at the state level. This allows us to respond rapid crisis response. But the public health and emergency response issues we need to deal with are changing. Over the last couple of years, this has been from the opioid issue with the creation of the OSMAP office, to the ongoing, we have STDs or STI issues across the state, our abuse of alcoholism, tobacco cessation projects, and, you know, now we've got greatly increased fire seasons to earthquakes and new foreign viruses. So the importance of public health has never been greater. I'm immensely proud and humbled that Chief Medical Officer Dr. Ann Zink wanted to work with me as we address these complex issues as we try to continue the modernization of the Division of Public Health. I'm going to steal some phrases and quotes from Governor Hickel's 1993 publication of the History of Health and Social Services in Alaska. Public health in Alaska started in 1893 with the arrival of the first professional nurse into Bethel. 3 years before, the first doctor arrived and 23 years before the first hospital was built in the area. I figured Senator Giesel would appreciate that. For many, the traveling nurse was the only source of health care, traveling across the state by dog sled, riverboat, and on foot. They carried basic kits with them, but they incorporated health education and disease prevention in their primary health care practices. Today, the public health nurses continue that mission by being the front line in our communities, working to address local issues, and often being the first to share information of concern back to the Division of Public Health. The division itself is responsible for the health emergency operations and response, crisis communication, strategy, data building, and information sharing. Dr. Ann Zink mentioned last week that our goal, I guess it was 2 weeks ago, our goal is to activate the Emergency Operations Center and respond to issues before there are outbreaks. A prime example is a confirmed case of measles last summer that was isolated and contained to that single case, which is a tremendous accomplishment when you talk about such a transmittable disease. As emergencies occur, this team coordinates with local municipalities, health facilities, and responders to ensure our healthcare systems have the support and supplies they need to remain open. Examples of this are the earthquake of 2018 and working with not only hospitals, but small assisted living homes to make sure residents had proper medical supplies when the roads are shut down. I can be, you know, from experience, this was 2 days before I officially took over, but being on those emergency operations calls, we actually had to work with a small assisted living home to make sure they had oxygen tanks, medical grade oxygen, for some of their patients who couldn't travel outside. So it was items like that, just to make sure that coordination was underway and how did we respond to them. A recent example of our emergency response capabilities has made global news. With the ongoing outbreak, and officially it is now COVID-19, it's the coronavirus ID of 2019, came out of Wuhan, China. Alaska's geographic location has got a lot of importance because Anchorage is only a 9-hour flight from Wuhan. So public health has been running the Emergency Operations Center to monitor the situation, and we have weekly, if not daily, calls with federal partners as well as fellow state agencies to make sure we're fully prepared to respond. Once this current situation is resolved, we'll continue to fine-tune our response capabilities so we're ever ready to deal with whatever happens next. Some other examples of things we're working with in the Division of Public Health are our chronic health conditions and preventative measures. So there was something that came out of Senate Finance and Health Finance Committees the other day when it was our MESA report, our Medicaid enrollment and spending in Alaska. This actually identified and highlighted that chronic conditions are the main cost driver of the Medicaid program. And so getting out in front of that with prevention is a very key aspect. And so to integrate that into our system, we've actually had Division of Public Health Director Heidi Hedberg joins our weekly Medicaid director meetings, because as we're trying to address issues that they see, then how do we get in front of them on the front end? Education programs and processes.
Thank you. I just had a question upon sort of the, what we learned from that MESA report and Senate Finance. Are we looking at a way to help manage that those chronic cares, or looking at maybe as a managed care system, using Medicaid as a possibility of some of our what we're going to call overutilizers? It's a small percentage, and they mostly, we know the data, we know they live in the South Central area, Anchorage, Matsu, and Kenai. Is there a way that the department's looking at trying to have a more of a managed care system for those high utilizers?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, we've actually identified a lot of those eight chronic conditions out of the MESA report. One of them that we did address last year through regulation was ESRD, or end-stage renal disease. And we were able to actually find a cost savings ongoing to the state of about $1 million a year by dropping it down to Medicare instead of cost-based rate. So some other items like that that we are working on, there's a lot of different projects in play. There's the care management program that is already ongoing in Division of Healthcare Services, but we're really working with other groups. There's some other authorities that was expanded under 2016's SB 74. One of them is exploring bundled payments, meaning that how do we actually look at the utilization rates and how they're capped at, and then how do the group go in and manage that and actually set up some innovations and incentives for providers to provide savings? So we're trying to address that from there. Outside of that, you know, active engagement in things like the Play Day and the Play Summit, teaching education with schools about smoking, alcohol abuse through our YRBS, or a Youth Response Behavioral Survey, which is a federal thing from the CDC, and every 2 years we update that report and use this for policy decisions. Examples that we've seen in the community for successful pilot projects has been Petersburg School District actually removed all sugary drinks from their vending machines and cafeteria, and they implemented water bottle fillers throughout all the schools, elementary and high school, and they've actually increased that, and they've had fantastic outcomes across the board there. So we're just working with other schools about little investments like that in education process on these little choices which can have generational effects.
Thank you. And Commissioner, also, I just want to make sure where we're at the times to make sure we have enough time to go through all your slide deck. Senator DeGiesel.
So I'll keep it brief. You know, one of the most common chronic conditions is diabetes. And it's often pretty challenging for folks to find qualified care for diabetes. That is, care that is comprehensive. There's actually a nurse practitioner sitting in the room right now who has a clinic that specializes in that. But nurse practitioners are only reimbursed at 85% of what a physician is. And yet, if they can provide better care. So sometimes those kinds of financial things make all the difference in combating a chronic condition that ultimately results in renal disease. So that's not really a question. It's more a looking at a bigger picture. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator.
Through the chair, Senator Giesel. I appreciate that. And one of the things that the governor has encouraged us as we look at different programs throughout the department, if we look at either adding a license type or a different level of service, there is always going to be an initial cost to that. But does that cost turn into an investment with long-term savings? And, you know, not having all of the decision support tools we may need to do this, we are working with the staff to work on these decisions as opposed to just a flat no because of that initial note. What does that look like over time? And so when we pursue different regulatory packages or items like that, that is always a part of the discussion because we're trying to make sure, just what you said, are we allowing access to care? Because it doesn't matter what providers we have if people can't get in to see them.
Senator Begich.
Just again, I'll be brief too, kind of reinforcing that point. That wasn't the message from the administration last year. The idea that you're looking at what beyond the fiscal notes and looking at what the impact might be beyond the government expense in a policy matters, and that goes back to the SNAP question I asked earlier, because you really are talking about not just the implications to the state's budget, but what are the implications in the long run to the cost of health in Alaska to the average person or to the provider in this case. So I want to reinforce it and show you my appreciation for you saying that you're looking beyond those fiscal note costs, because it really is not a zero-sum game. There's other things involved here that need to be calculated when we're assessing whether a policy is going to, in the long run, benefit society. It's not just the government black or red line. It goes beyond that. I appreciate hearing that from you, Commissioner.
Sure. All right. Please continue.
And then the last item is the behavioral health continuum of care. This is something that I got to say, because of prior year's efforts in the legislature, My predecessors, dedicated stakeholders, we have had great progress in breaking down the stigma of behavioral health. It seems most of us will agree behavioral health issues affect us all, friends, neighbors, family members, and ourselves. Because of the diminishing stigma, the stage is set for the focused buildup of a behavioral health continuum of care. We have seen recent progress of community-level investment over the last 2 years, examples being Fairbanks Memorial Hospital bringing online a dedicated behavioral treatment unit and designated evaluation and treatment center in January of 2019. Matsu Regional recently unveiled their behavioral health treatment, and they have successfully now a designated evaluation and treatment center as well. This community investment is necessary to provide acute behavioral health services in community, and we are grateful these communities and organizations are stepping up and building that capacity. Another key piece has been the 1115 Medicaid waiver for mental health and SUD treatment or substance use disorder. It's a multi-year effort from parties all across the state, and it was an easy sell for the governor and myself to support this crucial endeavor. With the 1115, we have added 24 new service types that can bill Medicaid, providing services sooner at a more appropriate level of care and more local than before. The goal is to keep individuals working and families together by getting them the crucial help and treatment they need before much more expensive interventions are required. Another avenue that has been open from the 1115 is a possible funding mechanism for crisis stabilization, which Deputy Commissioner Wall will speak on later on in the presentation. But I would like to say that this is not an exhaustive list of the things that we are working on. It's a good highlight of the overall perspective of the things that we are trying to attack. So, our mission is to protect and promote the health of all Alaskans. We're working that all can have the opportunity to live their best life. So as we move into the divisional aspect, the Alaska Pioneer Homes, updates on that is that we did receive approval for construction on the fourth floor of the Anchorage Pioneer Home to serve as neighborhood for those with dementia and other complex needs. This was a project that has taken a little bit of time to work with the municipality because of the way it was initially zoned as a building. We had to zone it correctly in order to do this, but this is something that we really believe is going to help overall. This is one of the holes in our whole system of behavioral health to provide this level of care. The other aspect is we are exploring the transition of an additional 22 beds to the higher Veterans Administration per diem rate for the veterans at the Alaska Veterans and Pioneer Home in Palmer. We have actually successfully transitioned 14 beds over to that, and you have to do it in complete units. There's a couple different protocol changes, but this is something you then apply for and work with, but it does bring in some additional revenue paid for by the VA.
Senator Bagich.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Very quick question. We, in testimony on a different piece of legislation, a few weeks ago, one of the suggestions that was mentioned by a testifier was that our Pioneer Homes don't qualify for certain levels because of our capital construction and the change in building codes and such, don't qualify for certain levels of reimbursement. And I'm out of my league here on this one a little bit. I'm looking over for a lifeline, which I may need. But that if we did bring our building, some of our buildings up to code, we could qualify for that higher reimbursement rate. Are you aware, is there any effort to try to bring our buildings up to that nursing home standard or not? And did I get that right, Senators?
Yeah.
So because that potentially could provide some relief for the costs of the Pioneers Home, recognizing that we are dealing with significantly higher levels of care.
Through the chair, Senator Bagich. Thinking about that, so the Pioneer Homes are licensed as assisted living homes, and to be a skilled nursing facility or a nursing home is a completely different level of license type. Some of the Pioneer Homes may provide nursing level home level of care, but I can look back and I'll get back to you with where we're at in that process as to if we're going to pursue that or if it's something we're not going to pursue and why. I'd like to backfill that, and I have to call out for Deputy Commissioner Lasley to come give some information on that.
Just a brief follow-up.
Yes, Senator Bagich.
And Commissioner, while you're doing that, as you go through that process, remember the bottom line issue that we were discussing just a moment ago. And it's really, if it's a capital expense that the Senate and the House might consider that would allow us to through that investment, be able to provide a greater level of care and a greater level of reimbursement in the long run, that it might actually, within the state funding stream, pencil out. So keep that in mind as you go through that process of review.
Senator Begich, through the chair.
Put your name on the record.
For the record, my name is Albert Wall. I'm Deputy Commissioner for the Department. There are a couple of different considerations in that. The capital expenditure bringing up to code is one of them, but I'd just like to point out that a skilled nursing facility has other requirements that have to do with staffing, training, and the type of services that they provide in the building, so we'll be happy to provide that to you.
Thank you.
For the record, again, this is Adam Crum, Commissioner. Focus up back on. So for behavioral health, so actually just to the chair, just so you know, for all the divisions, we're doing highlights of each thing that we're pursuing. So for the behavioral health side, one of the most important things we've attached over the last couple of years is the 1115 program. Their mission is to manage an integrated and comprehensive behavioral health system on sound policy, effective practices, and open partnerships. This has been an ongoing partnership that we've been working with the Mental Health Trust, with our community-based hospitals, with the Alaska Behavioral Health Association, with the Alaska Psychiatric Association, all these different groups across the board, trying to come and build a what is the full continuum of care that we need in Alaska. So it's not just API. So how do we actually provide services sooner and closer to home at a much more appropriate level? And this has been an ongoing battle that we've been really appreciative of all the partnerships we've been able to generate. And I'll pass this off to Deputy Commissioner Wall.
Thank you once again. For the record, my name is Albert Wall. I'm Deputy Commissioner for the Department of Health and Social Services. Talk a little bit about the 1115 Behavioral Health Medicaid waiver. It's really focused at three different groups. Children, adolescents, and their parents or caretakers at risk of mental health or substance use disorders, individuals with acute mental health needs, and individuals with substance use disorders. And we'll go through a little bit of information on each of those groups as we move forward. I would like to point out that the implementation of this did come out of Senate Bill 74 and has a lot to do with the fact that there are challenges in an ongoing way to the behavioral health continuum of services. In the first slide that the commissioner went over, he talked about the behavioral health continuum of care. Two of the challenges that we've always faced with that are one, the funding mechanism for behavioral health services in the state has been an arrangement between grant-funded services that are funded as a grant under the general funding of the state, and then Medicaid services kind of on top of that. And it's always been the arrangement that the Medicaid services have not quite paid for the service line, and so there's been a grant there, and there's been Medicaid services there, and the two between the two of them have met the needs and been able to provide services. The other challenge to the continuum of care is that there are simply services that are not covered under the old Medicaid system for behavioral health, and so there were gaps in our continuum of service. I bring that out because the 1115 is designed to rectify that situation, to introduce new services that are billable under Medicaid and reduce the need on general funded grants. So back to the slide. There are really two phases to the 1115. When working with CMS and our implementation of it, they ask us to break it into two different parts. The first part is the substance misuse disorder treatment component. It was approved in November of 2018. It became effective January 1st, and I'm going to show you the slides at which new services are introduced, but I'd like to point out that it is being served right now. One of the big pieces of that was the IMD exemption. There is a structure in CMS that will not allow you to bill for Medicaid services in a Institute of Mental Disease that has over 16 beds. Long history on the federal side with that. Suffice it to say, it has limited our ability to pay for services for substance abuse and for serious mental illness in institutes over 16 beds. They ask us to break it into two pieces, and the first part has already been approved, and we have service providers in the state who are currently billing Medicaid for over 16 beds in substance use treatment, which is tremendous. We're very happy about that, and indeed the first claims through the new ASO have been made and are being processed, and that's a good thing. The second portion of that is the behavioral health component, which was approved in September of 2019 and will be implemented at the end of this fiscal year. That covers the mental health portion of this, so those with serious mental illness or children with serious emotional disturbance. That also has the IMD portion in it, the Institutes of Mental Disease portion in it. Should that be granted and approved fully, when that's implemented, we will be able to bill for inpatient psychiatry and other inpatient treatment for mental health in institutes of over 16 beds. And I'll just take a second to point out that that would include API, and we'll talk about that a little bit later.
A couple of questions here. Senator Von Imhoff.
Thank you. So you just said a lot, trying to follow along. And I do know that there are buckets. Adults and kids are treated differently. Mental health and or drug treatment also treated differently. Commissioner Crum had brought up Fairbanks Memorial Hospital, and I think you highlighted some of the work that they've been doing there. I did have the privilege of flying to Fairbanks this past fall and toured the facilities there and got to see firsthand the terrific work that they're doing. I think you were alluding to the fact that funding is in jeopardy potentially. I believe that this was a $2 million grant, and I forgot the acronym DHAP. D's, there's a D in there.
The DISH.
Okay. And so is this – so what's going to happen to this terrific program that has spent a couple years putting it together that is filling a gap in the mental health continuum of care in Fairbanks? If this DISH funding goes away, what are – just talked about that. What's going to happen?
Senator Van Imhoff, through the chair, I appreciate the question, and you're right. It is a very complex issue. And – as you said, you just said a lot in a short period of time. So let me see if I can break this down. There are different forms of Medicaid and different services and rates are paid for those different sections of Medicaid. So some of those sections have to do with ages, and some of those sections have to do with diagnosis and types of treatment. Typically under Medicaid, you bill under the titles or the federal authority that's given to that particular portion of Medicaid. So Title 19 for adults, Title 21, Denali Kid Care for children and pregnant women. The services that have in the past been provided underneath those regular Medicaid sections for behavioral health have been billed under the state plan under what's clinic services and rehab, as opposed to what a hospital would bill or physician services bill or any other type of services. They're billed under these two types of service called clinic services and rehab. Substance abuse falls into the rehab side of the house. So it is very complex. What the 1115 does is it takes those clinic services and rehab and kind of outdates those, replaces them with a whole new package that's billed in a different format. It's billed in a different way. It's billed in typically in bundled payments. And you'll see in the slides that in the old system, they were billing in very small increments, sometimes down to 15-minute increments for interventions for behavioral health. Under the 1115, they can bill in a bundled rate up to 23 hours of stabilization for different types of services. And so it includes more services, and the administrative overhead is a lot less under the 1115 than it was under the old system. The issue of inpatient psychiatric care is just a little bit different, and it's hard to parse that one out because it does have something to do with the 1115 in that the 1115 allows us to bill over 16 beds for Medicaid inpatient psychiatric. However, they're still billed under the hospital services. So those are billed under hospital services for terms of Medicaid. The funding that you were talking about called disproportionate share for hospitals is basically divided under two buckets for the state. One is kind of what we typically get, an allocation that we have with the federal government, which allows disproportionate share or a chunk of money to go to hospitals for those who are providing care for people who don't have coverage. A large portion of that does go to API because we're not allowed to bill for Medicaid for the people that are currently in it because it's above 16 beds. There was a second allocation of DISH funding that was made available through the legislature. We appreciate that. It gave us more authority on the federal side of the house. It requires a general fund match, and it was given for a couple of years. And you are correct. That authority is coming to an end, I believe, at this fiscal year.
And the acronym for DISH?
Disproportionate Share for Hospitals.
I just want to make sure for the record. Thank you.
Thank you. And Senator Van Imhoff through the chair. So the DISH funding of about $4.5 million general fund, matched with $4.5 million Fed is what we put forward in our Morse plan to satisfy a pending court case. And so this is an item that we look at, and we recognize the importance of our DETs, our designated evaluation and treatment centers like Fairbanks, Bartlett Hospital, and Matsu, the investment that they've made and to get their system in work. Because, you know, it's not only just that. They've also worked with their court system up there in Fairbanks as well, and they've done a very good job trying to stabilize that. So this is something that we have put forward and working on getting that finalized with the judge and with the plaintiff to make sure that it is approved, and I believe it was put forward in the amended budget.
Okay. So Fairbanks, under a Morse plan, that's the first I've heard of it, are they going to get their DISH funds to help continue this program that you highlighted that is working? From my perspective, are they going to get their money this year?
Through the chair, yes, they are one of the intended recipients of that program.
Great.
I have a couple of questions here on the 1115 waiver. You mentioned, Deputy Commissioner, about the grants. Your previous administration have went around for years talking about Medicaid expansion, and Medicaid expansion would help lessen the need on state grants because you would have billable services. The influx never really came through to a lot of behavioral health grantees, or we've asked, I know other providers have asked, for the data to show that the billables the amount of billable services were actually offsetting the cost for grants. That data never came through. I think the Alaska Native Health Board also wrote a white paper on how those funds never came through. So with the additional billing of 1115 waivers and some of those grantees that were getting services for grants that were covering services that Medicaid did not pay for, are we actually seeing those providers billing for Medicaid now? I know you only have a small pool of providers to go off of, but are those providers actually making up sort of those grant services that were offered? And if so, is this budget year or next budget year we'll see further reductions in grant services to those behavioral health providers?
Yeah, thank you for the question, Mr. Chair. Yes, for the large providers of the SUD services that were grant recipients, we've actually seen through this initial billing phase that they have been made more than whole through the Medicaid funding of the portion of the grants that they were decreased. So this is actually exciting. That is the intent of the way this process was supposed to work, the refinancing through the Medicaid side, because a higher proportion of the individuals they see are the Medicaid expansion population at the higher 90% FMAP. As we move in the future, we have not proposed behavioral health grants for this coming year because we want to maintain stability through the system for this year while we get the rest of the providers signed up with the administrative service organization to become 1115 Medicaid providers for these services. So we want to make sure that we have a nice overlap, that they can come in, their service can be there, and any lag in the system, the technical assistance and guidance can be provided by the ASO, by the department, to make sure that they're up and running, and then we see and evaluate, and then we can put forward further grant reductions if necessary.
Great news. And then I guess my second question was going to be upon the rate of reimbursement for the 1115 waiver. So you're saying some of them may be on the 90% FMAP rate instead of the 50% FMAP rate?
Mr. Chair, again, this is Albert Wall, Deputy Commissioner for the Department. So it's based on their eligibility type. So if they are eligible for the higher match rate, so say they're Denali KidCare, or they're under that match rate. If they're in the expansion group, they're under that match rate, and if they're under the normal adult group, they're under that match rate. So it depends on their eligibility type.
Thank you.
For the next couple slides, these are the different services that were added. So this is slide 7, 8, and 9. They're broken out into what is the children's side, for the mental health continuum of care, what is the individuals 18 years and older, and then what is the substance use disorder for 12 and older. So when you look at these slides, the ones that are in blue are the new service types that have been added under the 1115 waiver.
And I guess as my question is, as we look through these slides, do we have enough providers in the state of Alaska that can currently bill? I know that we added, you mentioned that we added 12 different provider types. Is that enough provider types to help meet the demand of these services that are now offered in the blue to allow for this additional, I guess, revenue for these providers?
Mr. Chair, it is somewhat of a mixed bag at this point, so the answer is not altogether no or yes, and I hate to hedge on that, but let me explain. There are some specific service lines. So, for example, the Crisis Stabilization Center, which is a facility-based service, and we'll talk about that in a minute, but they don't exist in the state right now. There are none of those. We will have to build the licensure type, staff them, and stand them up as a separate provider type. For the, some of the other provider types are already up and running, and they're licensed, and they're doing their thing. And so the answer is kind of a mixed bag. Some will have to be licensed and bring in more providers, and some will not.
Yes, Senator Geisel.
So I'm going to follow up on that. So the law was changed a couple years ago that removed the psychiatrist supervision. And so now a physician can supervise clinical social workers, clinical counselors, family therapists. Has that been implemented, and are we seeing more services available? There was a two-year waiting list in Anchorage at some of these facilities just a few years ago.
Through the chair, Senator Geisel, that regulatory package is completed. We are waiting for final signature from the Lieutenant Governor's office, but we are moving with that, and so we are very excited to have that hit the street.
2 years ago, the bill passed. Thank you.
Senator Geisel, I personally feel your pain. I, too, have a regulatory package. It took a little 2 years to I think we're at the same spot. But with that, I appreciate that. So with knowing the provider types and licensure types, is that done through regulatory change, or are we looking at statutory change that also needs to occur? And if we're looking at statutory change, are we looking at doing that, completing that within this legislative cycle or the next legislative cycle?
Mr. Chair, again, and not to play coy, it depends on the provider type and the licensure. So there are some that will require some regulatory change. There are some that will require a statutory adjustment, and there are some that will not require anything. So it is a mixed bag.
Can I follow up on that?
Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So are you going to give us some guidance in that, or will we be throwing darts at a dartboard trying to guess it? Because 2 years is a long time for a regulatory change. If we add on top of that a statutory change, we're talking about, you know, 4 years or 5 years potentially. So can you give us a little guidance on that as that process moves forward?
Yeah. Thank you, Senator Baggage, through the chair. I really appreciate that. And I feel the frustration as well. I have been working on this for many years. And just to go back to the case in point of psychiatrists no longer having to be the 30% over the top of behavioral health providers, that's been an ongoing frustration in this field for many years. And there's really basically under the old state plan for behavioral health, there was really only three defined provider groups that could even provide behavioral health services. A clinic being one of them that had to have a psychiatrist oversight, a psychologist being another one, an LCSW being another one, and they could only provide limited services. So the frustration is real, and I understand. I would say that we are putting together the roadmap for that. The biggest partners that we have in this process are our associations and groups in the trust. And some of those are the Alaska Behavioral Health Association, which we are working closely with. The trust is kind of the driving force behind the movement of the crisis stabilization, which is what we're moving towards. And we'll talk a little bit about that in just a second. Primary Care Association, the Hospital Association, the Association of Homes for Children, all of these groups we have talked to about, you know, what's coming in the 1115 and what we need to put in place to ensure its delivery of services. The first phase was substance abuse. And its implementation, we already have all those license types and all those services lines. And so that what is currently in place has what it needs. Moving forward, the roadmap is being developed. And again, we're very thankful for the trust and their involvement in that. They have a vendor that has put together a report. We could be glad to make that available to you. I was going to mention it under the next couple of slides here.
Senator Von Imhoff.
Thank you. So you did mention, you kind of bundled these slides, slides 7, 8, and 9, individuals of different age groups. The blue is the new services provided. In addition, and then Senator Wilson here asked about the different matching. So I have talked to you about this before, Commissioner Crum. With the subcommittee process starting, there's a couple of us sitting on that subcommittee for Health and Social Services. What's going to be the fiscal note with the varying demand of all these blue services and the next three pages in the various different matching. And I understand that we may be going transitioning from traditional grants that we've been doing in behavioral health and lessening those grants and ramping up the match. I'm assuming it's not going to be net zero. So can you, and you don't necessarily have to ask this today, but just know, or excuse me, answer this today, but just know our subcommittee process, I believe, begins tomorrow at 7:45 in the morning, and that will be one of the very big questions we'll be asking.
Through the chair, Senator Inhofe, thank you for that. Yes, we'll provide that information. One thing to note, just also for the public as well, is that the 1115 waiver process has to be cost neutral or savings to the federal government over time. And it's a five-year process for the each initial waiver. And so we had to put forward a plan that actually projected out. And it's not just our projections. We actually had to pay for actuarial analysis to make sure that that would be the case.
Okay. Senator Von Imhoff.
Cost neutral to the federal government? What about cost neutral to the state government?
And then we would have, I apologize, through the chair, we would actually have the way the expanded services would go, we actually, yes, would have the plan we put together would have cost savings to the state as well, because it's also a buildup of the continuum. And this is the idea, is we're getting these individual services quicker so they're not ending up in the emergency departments. And so there would be anticipated savings under that. And we do have specific tracking mechanisms that we have to report back to CMS.
Thank you.
Representative Von Imhoff, I'm sorry, Senator Von Imhoff, I apologize, through the chair. Once again, I'd also like to point out that a good portion of this is already in the operational budget for the current year and is being operated on and is included in the next budget for Medicaid already. So the fiscal notes have already been accomplished for those.
Thank you.
Please continue. And we got to start picking up.
I'm sorry?
We got to start talking faster.
Yes, Mr. Chair, I shall attempt to. Okay, so this is the piece, the last couple of slides are the ones that I'm tremendously excited about because I think they solve a lot of problems in the state around behavioral health. I wanted to point out that the state is rapidly moving towards a crisis stabilization type behavioral health approach. There are a couple of organizations in a couple of states in the nations that in the nation that follows this. We have been having technical assistance trips to the state of Arizona because our 1115 most closely matches theirs in any of operational states that have 1115s. Their whole system of care is built around this behavioral health crisis stabilization idea. And it has in it four pillars. I want to talk about those briefly because just to describe the situation right now, when someone has a behavioral health crisis, and just I'm going to use Anchorage as an example. I know there's many others. If they have a behavioral health crisis and they're picked up, usually they're picked up at either an ambulance or they're picked up by a police officer on some sort of charge, there's really only two places for them to go. They go to either the emergency room or jail. And sometimes they sit there for a long period of time, as you mentioned earlier, waiting for services to arrive. Under the crisis stabilization center, crisis stabilization approach, it's kind of turned upside down in that they don't go to jail and they don't go to an emergency room. They are handled entirely different. I'll describe it in this way. There are four pillars to the crisis stabilization approach. One is a call center, which is designated to handle all crisis calls. And de-escalate. That is their primary job. They, in the state of Arizona, they describe it as an air traffic control center. They have all calls coming in, whether those are suicidal threats or behavioral health disturbance on A Street or whatever it is, they're all coming into one central location. The call center takes the call, and in 75% of the cases are able to de-escalate on the call without any further intervention. If you are aware of what's going on in, say, Anchorage right now with behavioral health calls, that's remarkable. If we could do just that alone, that would be tremendous. But that's the first step. The next step is if they can't stabilize on the phone, they actually launch a crisis response team, which is made up of two individuals, a mental health professional and a peer. And those two individuals go on site and they de-escalate on site. And again, there's a tremendous percentage of times that they can de-escalate on-site without any further intervention. If they can't de-escalate or they need further help, they take that individual to a crisis stabilization center, which is a facility, and I talked about it a little bit earlier. The crisis stabilization center takes all police officers that are bringing people in, takes emergency or EMT vehicles that are coming in with behavioral health, and they take these crisis response teams that are coming in with behavioral health. They're brought to the stabilization center. their primary goal at that stabilization center is not the typical of an emergency room, which is diagnosis, treatment, and saving of lives, but the crisis stabilization center is just that, to stabilize. So they want to de-escalate the problem and hook that individual up with ongoing services that will help them with their needs. And the fourth is a robust behavioral health continuum of care. And I think in the last couple of slides we've covered that, yes, we currently don't have that. Under the 1115, it will be built as a robust behavioral health continuum of care. In the interest of time, I can take some questions on that. I could go on for days about this program because I love it, but this really changes the approach of a social response to behavioral health. Rather than having police officers with an individual who's acting out in an emergency room waiting for hours to hand them off to medical staff, in Arizona, they literally do the handoff in 3 to 5 minutes, and the police officers are back doing public safety work. It is remarkable, the turnaround, and I really appreciate the involvement of many of the legislators who have gone down on those trips, Senator Wilson, Senator Michicki, Representative Spunholz, and Johnston have all been in part of those, so we appreciate the involvement.
And the one thing I'll add to that, Commissioner Wall, is that for those folks that think that this is going to be a huge government involvement, government has to stand these up, it's done by a lot of the community members and other sort of, I don't want to say contracting services, but here in Alaska, we already have a lot of these pieces in place. It's just trying to get a better coordination of those resources we already have in the state to pull this together with a limited government growth in terms of to administer something like this. So Senator Begich.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Deputy Commissioner, walk me through how that works in rural Alaska, where you don't have law enforcement, where you don't have the capacity for a crisis team, where you don't have the ability to put two people necessarily on the ground in minutes. How does that – I think this is a good idea for urban Alaska.
Senator Begich, through the chair, I appreciate that question. I do. We've had a very robust discussion around that. It's interesting. On one of the trips, they brought their tribal liaisons on in, and we had some question and answer time with them. Arizona, of course, Alaska is very unique. Arizona does have some unique challenges as well. Okay, they don't have a St. Lawrence Island, right? But they have a tribal village on the bottom of the Grand Canyon, which is only accessible by mule. And yeah, there's some unique challenges there. The system is built to be flexible, and CMS, the federal government, is working with the tribes in particular on how to make it work with them. And I'll give you an example. In one of the villages, they described how they don't train a team, the crisis response teams. They train all the able-bodied adults, and they basically hand off the phone. So Bob's going to take it for 12 hours, and Sam's going to take it for the next 12, and they hand off the phone, and they're trained in how to respond. There's some very, what I would call, innovative approaches that CMS has taken with this. In the state of Arizona, just for example, transportation by horseback is a Medicaid reimbursable service. So I'll just tell you that there are some innovations that CMS is willing to do around this issue. I'm not saying we're going to get dog sleds approved. I'm just saying that they're very innovative in their approach. They want this to work. It's proven to bring down cost. It's proven to provide better care. It's proven to provide longer-term stability, and it changes the face of the culture. I was very impressed with what I saw in Arizona, and I'm very hopeful for what it can do in the state.
Mr. Chairman, I'm looking forward to seeing those innovations written out. So I'm very fascinated by this.
I'm very hopeful.
All right. Thank you. Next slide we've got is the Alaska Psychiatric Institute. One thing about this, it's important to know that this is a hospital. And so we actually have tried from the department level to actually start managing like a hospital with an active governance board. And so we have 26 individuals from the public and private sector who take an active role. These are individuals representing local hospitals, Representative ASHNA, the Behavioral Health Association, Psychiatric Association, across the board, as well as public advocates. They're sitting there making decisions on leadership. And so they are actually currently going through the hiring process of interviewing and hiring a permanent CEO at API. And so this has been a very good process of the last number of months to get that level of involvement. We are currently sitting at 50 beds for the census, and it's been a very good thing. Last spring we had an emergency situation because we had
almost 400 outstanding cases of violations from our certifying and accrediting bodies. And so we were at the very real threat of it being shut down and defunded from the federal dollars. And so we had to bring in a company called WellPath, and they helped us not to run the whole facility. They helped us management. We had brought them in as a team. They brought stability and training aspects. So they actually put national training standards. A lot of the plans of corrections that I just mentioned, we've corrected 92% of those. Most of those plans of corrections were helped written with WellPath's guidance, and they helped us actually actively recruit into Alaska, state of Alaska positions, hiring state of Alaska employees because of their national reach, because of the overall image of the facility has improved. And for those who have toured the facility over the years, it is a completely different feel now than it has been in years past. So it's a tremendous aspect. We're looking forward to growing that and stabilizing that further. Office of Children's Services. You may note that this is actually a new mission statement for them over this last year, ensuring the safety, permanency, and well-being of children by strengthening families, engaging communities, and partnering with tribes. So this is it's an ongoing issue with OCS because we're dealing with families and kids at their most vulnerable. It's very emotional time, so we're trying to find what we can provide from a department level to give families the support they need to make sure that they are getting the family resiliency tools that they can stay together. So some things that OCS has worked on over the last year is innovative recruitment retention efforts. We have reduced turnover to 43% from 51%. That's still not where we want to be, but that is a tremendous improvement. So we're working on frontline staff, relieving them of administrative functions, and trying to make it easier for them to do their jobs, to be out in the field. We have increased the number of children placed with relatives thanks to help from our tribal partners through tribal compacting, an example being that we have them do our family and relative searches. And then we also have more youth exiting foster care to college or vocational programs than ever before. We have an independent living program, which takes an innovative approach, making sure that those kids who are aging out of the foster care system have an active path. They're not just goodbye, we'll see you later. What are your plans? Where are you going to go live? How are these funding sources set up? This is also a combination of a partnership that expanded beyond that for all at-risk youth that the Department of Labor has set up. They've actually hired a coordinator to coordinate funds from WIOA and DVRs, Division of Voc Rehab, along with all foster kids, kids leaving juvenile justice, any of those processes right there, so we can make sure these youth have the tools, because they may not have the family supports at home when they're out on their own. And if you go talk to the youth now, it's been fantastic. I sat down with one kid, and he has it all planned out for the next 2 years, where he's going to live, what vocational program he's going to do, and where he's going to go work. And that is more lined up than most adults I know. So I was very proud of that moment and proud of our staff.
Yeah, Senator Vandenhall.
Thank you. So a couple years ago, we did pass a bill addressing OCS. We added more money for more social workers as or case managers, as well as we had provisions like siblings staying together. I think kids as young as 14 years old being able to participate into their care plan, things of that nature. And I think one of the provisions was to provide, I believe it was an annual for 3 years, kind of an annual report of an audit of how's it going? Has it had any impact? Are you familiar with the bill that I'm talking about?
Yes, through the chair, yes I am. It was 151, correct?
151. And are we going to be seeing in the next 6 months or so maybe an update on how those provisions are? Are 14-year-olds happy that they get to be participating in their care?
Yes, we will be doing an update report. I was trying to find if they had the exact date of when it would be released.
Okay, thank you very much.
Keep going.
Yes, please continue.
All right, the next one is our Division of Juvenile Justice. So this has been an active year. So we've had recidivism reduction for youth served by DJJ Secure Treatment. So we actually, our FY 2019 recidivism numbers show a 35.9% recidivism rate for youth released from a high from FY 2012 of 71%. So it's a tremendous goal right there. That is a massive achievement to make sure that you're giving them the support, the care, and the tools they need to go back out and thrive in the community. Yes, sir. We've also had an expansion of our trauma-informed and response practices, or what's called TIERS. This has been excellent. It's screening to help staff work with youth to address behavioral health issues, how we train and how we deal with them, how we interact. And then we've done multiple projects to expand services for youth substance abuse and mental health.
Senator Begich.
Two quick questions, Mr. Chairman. Thank you. The first is, in the recidivism measures between 2012 and today, is it the same measure? Because we often change how we measure recidivism rates. So back in 71, it was a two-year. I'm pretty sure in 2012, when it was 71%, it was measured over 2 years. And is it still being measured over 2 years? So is that apples to apples is what I want to know.
Senator Baker, through the chair, I'll confirm that and get that back to you with what that measure is.
Thank you. And I think, Mr. Chairman, I think you know that I used to work in the division, so I'm very conscious of how we measure recidivism. It's a moving target often. But the second question is, you didn't mention the facilities. You may be about to mention them, but what are we going to do with the Nome facility since that's on the chopping block again this year? What is the goal with the Nome facility?
Senator Baker, to the chair, thank you for that question. We've actually had we successfully were able to transition out of the Nome youth facility over the last year. And part of the innovative practice in order to do that is now we have six facilities around the state. And so we have gotten our IT services actually up. This is another IT win. We actually are able to use video teleconferencing for individuals and the kids to actually connect back with their families. We've got dedicated tablets that we can issue them that they can actually call, talk to family members, have that level of interaction. Because only having six facilities around the state, that means that there's only six communities where kids are really local. And so this is outside of just the Nome, we wanted to make sure that everyone from around the state, if they have to be in that facility, they do have access and those ties back to their community. Working on the Nome facility in particular, we've actually had some very good communications and with the Norton Sound
Health Corporation. Norton.
Health Corporation, I apologize, yeah. We actually sat down with them, and we're working on a plan to actually utilize that. Part of our goal with that process is to make sure that facility is used in the best community way possible. And they're actually another group that I'm remiss for not speaking them earlier that has done tremendous investment in their behavioral health side for their local community. And so we have some exciting ideas that we're not ready to bring public yet because we're still working with them, but it's been very promising.
And I just also want to say thank you for your members in the MATSU. They've done a wonderful job in terms of dealing with the recidivism and the programs that they've implemented and the way that they handle with those kids. I know they had an incident early this year, and no one was seriously hurt. The kids were able to respond, and they did a fantastic job in the response of that crisis that they had there.
Thank you, sir. Yeah, that's I've been able to visit that facility a number of times, and it's – to see the level of, and I've been able to see most of the facilities we have in the juvenile justice and the youth side, and the same message that the staff speak over and over, the consistency of the approach of leadership. I'm very grateful for that because I think we're on the right track there in trying to get more active because it's not just facilities as though it's also probation. It's in the community, it's youth, and making sure they're engaged, that they're making the right choices when they're not behind the walls.
And before your next slide, I'm going to lead off with a question here for you. I know that we started the presentation off with a reorganization of what you stated for and the way that you want to reorganize, and I agree with I think eight predecessors since your time have spent about 95% of their time on Medicaid-related issues, and a lot of the programs that have been broken out, like I think the Deputy Commissioner for Family Health Protection Services, have always been negated in that ask. I know that in the other body, they sort of defunded that commissioner, deputy commissioner. Can you talk upon why additional commissioner and the way that the reorg is beneficial, sort of the return on the investment that we're going to add? Because this is going to obviously have additional costs, yep. But how that additional costs may lead to better outcomes. Since I'm not on the subcommittee, this is my only time to ask that question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Presented on the screen is what we have as a proposed org chart for an item that we put forward in the governor's proposed FY21 budget. This would actually add a new deputy commissioner position along with a couple policy staff that would oversee OCS, the Office of Children's Services, and the Division of Juvenile Justice, as well as bring over Adult Protective Services. We wanted to make sure there was alignment and mission focus. The two main divisions that this requested deputy commissioner would oversee manage urgent situations in which families, children, parents, and lives are frequently at stake. They're some of the most important decisions state government can make, separating parents from their children, determining how to handle minors who've committed serious offenses, and how to intervene when lives are in crisis.
OCS issues are now the most frequent reason why constituents contact the commissioner's office as well as contact you as legislators. We recorded over 100 independent inquiries over the last year regards to OCS, many of them beginning when an unhappy parent or confused foster parent has reached out to you. OCS and DJJ together employ almost 1,000 people across the state. Their numbers, plus the fact that they work directly with the public on stressful, painful issues, mean those employees actually demand an extraordinary amount of human resource time and attention. This involves debriefing of stressful cases, creative solutions for placement for a family preservation, how to support OCS in recruiting and retaining more frontline social workers, and supporting the director positions and their leadership staff to provide input into innovations and system change. So decisions from these divisions are frequently, they must be supported or given final clearance by the level of the commissioner's office. I'm going to paraphrase a recent conversation with John Sherwood, where he described deputy commissioners as traffic cops, saying, no, 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 you go, you go, you go, and that because of the constant pace and the timing of when decisions are required, some things you have to actually brace off and some things you need to get answers to now. It doesn't matter when that is. The directors do work very closely with their assigned DC, our deputy commissioner, for policy support and emergency decisions. Examples being emergency placement of kids with complex behaviors or medical conditions or approving emergency transports. These positions will not only allow better support for these divisions in navigating their difficult work, but perhaps more importantly, they'll allow us to take real steps toward changing the conditions under which child protection systems and juvenile justice systems are needed. We have a lot of work to do in enhancing our partnerships with tribes, communities, stakeholders, and the day-to-day work simply doesn't allow that kind of effort. For example, continued work on the Tribal Compact for Welfare takes a tremendous amount of time and leadership. It's too important an effort to try and fit in with just a few hours a month. Growing government is not something you'd associate with this administration, but we view this not as a cost, but as an investment. We've all seen the data over the years on adverse childhood experiences, or ACEs, and how higher ACE scores are directly correlated to increases in chronic conditions like diabetes, hypertension, and heart attacks. Recently, in the Senate Finance Committee, an economist brought forward the disproportionate cost of chronic conditions to the Medicaid program, as well as the projected growth of the program to be a $5 billion spend by 2040. If we can truly work on keeping families together, giving them the tools they need to thrive, and therefore not contributing to ACEs or traumatizing children, then it really is an investment in the next generation that we can finally bend the curve on multi-generational issues that result in child abuse, neglect, or delinquent behavior. The department has several cost drivers that do demand attention from all current leadership. The goal of a dedicated DC and policy team is to work upstream and focus on systematic changes. They won't be siloed from other divisions, but they will be charged with taking care of young Alaskans and making our families stronger. So that's why we put forward these four new positions: a deputy commissioner, a project coordinator, a special assistant, and a program coordinator. The idea behind them is the project coordinator would be assigned as an ICWA or tribal liaison specialist. They would represent the department in all manners, building relationships with our tribal partners as they build up their infrastructure to deal with our child welfare issues as well. And we try to make sure that these services are provided much more on a local level.
All right. Questions on this? All right, Commissioner, I'm going to have to cut you off here because we'll be here for another 30 minutes, I think, going through the rest of the slides with potential questions. But if you had a closing comments, and if we can just maybe just get a written quick little what's new and exciting in the Division of Public Assistance. You talked about Division of Public Health, Senior Disability Services, Healthcare Services, and Medicaid.
Yes, sir.
And just any of your closing comments. I don't want to cut you off just cold turkey, but also to lead out saying that I appreciate the commissioner's being able to reschedule. It was not his fault that we had this late in the session. That was all the chairman's responsibility and with his scheduling situation. And I thank the commissioner, deputy commissioner, and the department for being able to reschedule this committee hearing.
Thank you, sir. I'd just like to say I appreciate the time of the committee. It's always engaging questions. I appreciate the conversations we've had. You've driven us towards innovation, and we've had some robust discussions about different policy issues. This is it's a job that's never dull. So people ask, how's it going? There's never a dull moment. But I love the people I work with. I love the mission that we have, and I love the people that we serve. And so this is our opportunity as Alaskans to really address some of these very difficult situations for the long term, not just in the next year or the next 5 years. We have to look down the next 20 years on the services that we're providing and how is this going to look in Alaska and what is the system we want to have. So I appreciate going down this path with you, and thank you for your time.
Any committee members' closing comments for the day? Seeing none, thank you again, Commissioner and Deputy Commissioner Wall. This concludes our business for this afternoon. On Friday, we'll have initial overview of Senate Bill 134, Medicaid coverage for licensed counselors, by myself, Senator Wilson. We are adjourned at 2:57 p.m. Thank you.